Hi, this is spoken word artist Tribal Rain.
And this is Max Parthas, host of New Abolitionist Radio, Modern Day Slavery Abolitionists. And you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's broadcast, host Jessica Thomas will talk with Jeffrey Carey and Jennifer Shockley of Normal about the KC, Missouri ballot initiative to reduce penalties for possession of small amounts of cannabis. Then, in the second half, Margot Patterson will get a Missouri legislative update from 22nd District Representative Brandon Ellington. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Up next is Jessica Thomas and her guest. And welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. And this obviously isn't Jessica Thomas. Jessica is under the weather today. So this is Jeff Humfeld, and I'm sitting in for her. And our guests are Jennifer Shockley and Jeffrey Carey of Normal. And explain to folks what Normal is, please.
Normal, we're actually Normal KC, National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
And how did you get started, Jennifer? Jen?
Either which way. I have been in cannabis reform for quite a while. So I've been volunteering, and then Jamie Katz, our executive director, she decided to start a Normal chapter in Kansas City, 2015. So here we are.
And Jeff, how did you get started in this, or what brought you to this issue?
I'm an attorney in Lee Summit, and I've done a lot of work in the past on initiative petitions. I strongly believe in the rights of citizens to change their laws for the better. And I have, as a practicing attorney, have encountered a number of people that have had adverse contacts with the law resulting from marijuana, almost all of whom didn't deserve it. And so it's an area where I saw a real potential to make positive change. My main motivating factor is the people who have medical need that are currently branded as criminals. And this isn't obviously that, but it puts us a step closer in that direction.
Okay. You know, this is one of the things I've always said on this show and other places is that, you know, the reason we have so many young black men in jail is because we have old white men writing the laws. And, you know, that is, I like what you had to say about, you know, it's our right to change those laws.
It absolutely is. And in Kansas City, for example, according to the 2010 census, 29.9% of the Kansas City population was black. And in the latest data, 67% of the arrests for marijuana possession are black citizens.
Yep, and I've read in different places that marijuana use among the white population is actually higher than it is among the black population. So,
according to Normal, it's roughly equal, but yes, that's the rates are comparable, certainly.
Exactly. All right, let's talk a little bit about this initiative ballot, or an initiative that's on the ballot in Kansas City, Missouri, and what kind of effect it's going to have if it passes. And I know there is some controversy about it, so let's talk a little bit about what does the ballot actually say. You know, what are people going to see when they walk into the ballot the ballot box?
Well, the actual language is just going to ask the citizens if they should limit the authorized punishment imposed by the city of Kansas City for 35 grams or less of marijuana to a maximum $25 fine, eliminating jail time, and as a potential punishment, and also removing marijuana from the prohibition against drug paraphernalia so that they couldn't get at a charge in another way.
Okay. For old people like me, we had different names for 35 grams. You know, how much marijuana are we talking about, you know, in this amount? In other words, are we talking 2 or 3 rolled joints, or are we talking a baggie full, or what?
35 grams is an ounce and a quarter, so a normal Ziploc size baggie, some, you know, 3 or 4 fingers up.
Okay.
Anything over 35 grams is a felony.
Okie doke. Yeah, and that is something that people really need to be aware of. This would make this, you know, if this passed, this would make this a kind of like a traffic ticket. It's a municipal charge rather than a state or a federal charge.
Exactly.
What are some of the differences in that type of situation? In other words,
if I could clarify, words of caution for the public as well. This does change the penalties in Kansas City. There is concurrent jurisdiction in Jackson County. You are both in the city and in the county. You can be charged under state law for possession in the city of Kansas City. This does not eliminate that possibility. So that's something everyone has to keep in mind. Now, the state did recently reform their laws to lessen the penalties for possession for small amounts as well for first-time offenders. But that is important for everyone to consider. This is not a free-for-all. This is just a reform of the way it's being done in the city of Kansas City.
Okay. And, of course, we don't have any police officers here, but is part of the intention of this to kind of refocus them?
Certainly.
On the things that they really, you know, we really do need them to be doing rather than spending so much time on these types of infractions.
Over the last several years, had one-on-one conversations with police officers, you know, asking them what their opinion was, and every single last one of them said, this is not an issue. It's the drunks that we don't like. But none of them had a problem with it, but people are still being arrested. And at City Hall, they came out, and there was an officer that testified and showed what 35 grams looked like. And he said that the official stance of the Kansas City Police Department was neutral.
Okay. One of the things that's been, you know, used to by some folks to talk about this is the penalty. In other words, all right, $25, that's not much, and you're not looking at jail time or whatever. But what this does, it does create some kind of a record. It is a municipal record, but if someone really wanted, you know, an employer or somebody like that really wanted to look for something on you and deny you, they could find this record and use it to, you know, deny you employment or housing or other things like that. Is that accurate? Or?
Well, the federal student aid, they only ask for state and federal convictions.
Okay.
So not municipal offenses.
But certainly this does create a record that you did plead guilty to possession of marijuana, and it's something that would be disclosed or even be required to be self-disclosed on many background checks. That is one of the reasons, as I came in this, we actually negotiated. My negotiations spanned both Bill Geary and now Cecilia Abbott's tenures as city attorney. We negotiated language with the city to address some of their concerns. But one of the things we pushed very hard for was to have an explicit finding in this ordinance that the city council finds that diversion is an appropriate remedy for this infraction. Because that would allow people to go before the court and seek to have their prosecution set aside if they were to complete certain terms that the city may insist on. And that's actually led to the main area of opposition from the city as well, that very issue.
Okay. A couple other things that have come up about this is, and I'll remember it here in a moment. You know, what I should ask is, you know, are there concerns that you have, or there, you know, why do you think that people should vote for this particular ballot initiative?
Well, it keeps people from being arrested. You're possibly ripped out of your car, taken to jail, fingerprinted, mugshot. You're in the system. This way, you're not. I mean, there's a lot of heartache that goes into that, and that will avoid that.
Well, and I think it's really important from a standpoint both of setting a public policy that the citizens are advancing to say this is how we want this treated in our city. And that has a lot of positive impacts, in my opinion. It shows where the city stands on this issue. And it's something that politicians, frankly, have, they could have raised a long time ago. They have a hard time doing it because there is a no constituency, and that no constituency will punish politicians that come out front on issues like this. So it really is best led by the citizens. But the city has full authority to amend and repeal this ordinance. If they find any problems with it, they can adjust this over time, but we would then be negotiating from a position of already having passed it. And that does give advocates and people trying to protect civil justice a lot more leverage with City Hall.
Okie dokie. You know, one of the things that in conversation with Jessica, who was supposed to be here today, was that, you know, the amounts that people need for, what do you call it, for medical marijuana, in other words, if they're not smoking it, but they're actually making oil or using the oil, you know, what are the effects of this if you're carrying oil or you're carrying a vape thing or something or other and it's full or whatever? I mean, there are some fine points here, you know, that people probably need to understand.
Under the ordinance, weight is weight. It doesn't matter what form it is in.
Okay. Once again, you have folks that don't have a lot of money, and this would help them out. But if it creates a situation where they're crippled in some other way, is this really a good thing? I mean, in other words, like I said, the whole idea of an employer or even the city, if you went to get a city job, being able to use this.
That is the main concern that has been raised at City Hall and by some of the opponents, is that by removing the possibility of jail time, people accused would not then have the right to an appointed attorney. And the argument they're making is that would reduce their ability to go into diversion and do things to keep this off their record. In reality, however, that's purely discretionary with the judges and prosecutors. They don't have to have the only time you're entitled to have an attorney appointed is when your liberty may be taken away. So if there is a possibility of jail time, you are entitled to an attorney. Because that possibility of jail time is being taken away, there will be no more free appointments of attorneys for indigent people. However, the city certainly has the right to say, because there's no jail time imposed, there is not that need to have an attorney representing someone in negotiations. And they could negotiate directly with people for diversion. So, you know, the city, and I think everyone needs to get the message out that there are still negative repercussions. This is not legalization. You do need to be careful because absolutely this can have a negative impact on your future. And simply writing a check for $25 and sending it off isn't the end of possible consequences for you. So everyone needs to be smart about this. But it certainly provides relief and provides positive direction for the city.
Okay. Do either of you have a statement from Normal as to why you are doing this, and you know, is this a first step or is this a, you know, an end game or?
Well, this is a first step. Normal KC, we're looking at it coming from, you know, my mom passed away from cancer, so the medical side, definitely I'm for first step. Definitely in the city. I mean, we just can't come out and, you know, I'm not saying that I want full legalization, but, you know, it's not going to happen. We've got to start the conversation, and that's what we did. And Columbia, Missouri did it in 2004, so they've had a decriminalization initiative petition that they did then. And 2012, the city of St. Louis, the Board of Aldermen passed a decrim. So, and cities all over the United States have done this. We are not reinventing the wheel at all here.
Well, that's a good deal. I want to remind everyone they are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. And our guests are Jennifer Shockley and Jeffrey Carey. They're both representing normal. The National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws, and I always want to put an A in there somewhere, but it's not there. So
I would like to add something. So at yes. Tapcade 17th and McGee, we are having our watch party.
Oh, good deal.
Mm-hmm. Tuesday night.
And that's at 17th and
McGee. Yes.
Okay. Are there any other issues that have come up in your discussions of this that we haven't touched on?
Everybody that I presented the petition to when we were out signing were more than happy to sign it. And we did not...
We really didn't have any trouble getting the signatures passed. I actually had one of my I was only out there for, I think, 2 or 3 hours. I didn't have a lot of time to donate, and I came to this project late. But one of my signatories was a policeman. The other was a priest. So I had a couple, but people from all walks of life support this. And I think the important thing to remember is that we are trying to make a positive impact in Kansas City, but we are also looking to help build a coalition for social justice here in Kansas City. So for anyone out there listening, Normal KC, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on the web, we've got a website. We'd love to have your input and support moving forward.
All right, why don't you give that website, and if you have like a phone number or something, contact information?
NormalKC.org.
Okay, and no, is that all capital letters?
Yes.
And by normal, it's NORML. Like I said, there's no A or anything in there. .org. And no phone number?
No phone number.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming in. We are scheduled for a little bit longer, but our next guest has got to head to Jefferson City here pretty quickly. So we need to get him into the studio as soon as we can. Representative Ellington. So I want to thank both of you for coming in and giving us the scoop on this. And remember, polls open at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning.
So yes, indeed. Come out and vote.
Get out and vote, people.
Yes,
and
on five.
That goes for all elections, but this one too.
Yes. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, the calendar for April 3rd. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, April 3rd, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. Their mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and basic human rights for those that are incarcerated. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's REDROB 2655 at yahoo.com. The Kansas City chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, April 7th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. This month's presentation will be Advocacy Strategies and Tactics. You will meet local advocates and hear from them about their efforts. The panelists are Pastor Donna Simon, Mr. Ira Harrett, and Ms. Alice Kitchen. The KC Area Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting Friday, April 7th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, KCMO. POMC meets to provide assistance through ongoing emotional support, education, prevention, advocacy, and awareness to all survivors of homicide victims. The Kelsey Smith Foundation, Corey's Network, and Avila University are sponsoring a National Crime Victims Week vigil, Sunday, April 9th, from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Jeannie Hamilton Olufsen Plaza at Avila University. That's 11901 Warnell Road, KCMO. You can join them in remembering victims of crime and supporting their families in a spirit of strength, resilience, and justice. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Now to Margo.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Representative Brandon Ellington, a member of the Missouri State Legislature who represents the 22nd District. He is here today to talk us about prospects for criminal justice reform. A number of bills have been introduced into the state legislature that would affect those in prison, a few of them sponsored by Representative Ellington, and he's going to talk to us about some of those bills and where they stand. Representative Ellington, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Well, good. What do you think are the most important of the bills currently before the state legislature?
Okay, are you talking about my bills, or are you talking about the bills that's actually moving through the process right now?
Well, I'd like to talk about both.
Okay.
In terms of all of the bills, which do you think are the key bills and the ones that perhaps have the most chance of passage?
Okay, now these are not my bills. I do not endorse these bills, nor am I supporting these bills. But these are the bills that are more likely going to become law this year. Well, Right to Work has already been sent to the governor's desk. It was already signed by the governor. Prevailing Wage came out of the House last week. It's going over to the Senate this week. It's a good chance that prevailing wage will become law in the state of Missouri.
Now, what is that again? The what kind of wage?
Prevailing wage.
Basically, okay, prevailing wage.
Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
Sure. Well, let's focus on bills affecting criminal justice reform.
Okay. Ooh, major bills affecting criminal justice reforms that's outside of my legislation that I've written, there is none that's currently moving through the process right now. Yeah, there is none.
Okay. And talk to me about some of the ones you've introduced, particularly, I think I'm particularly interested in something called House Bill 507, which I think you sponsored. The Second Chance Act, is that right?
Yeah, basically what House Bill 507 and Representative Galen Higdon, who's a Republican, has also filed a piece of legislation that's almost exactly identical. And basically what this bill would do is it would allow inmates that have received a life sentence when they was a juvenile to come before, not just when they're a juvenile, when they received a life sentence to come before the probation and parole board. It doesn't guarantee them that they will be able to get released, but it should reduce the numbers that we have in our state penitentiary, and it allows people that have been locked up, that's been pretty much acquiring good time, even though we don't have a good time statute, meaning they haven't been a problem in our correctional facilities, that they can actually come before parole hearing to see if they can get early release.
Because currently, now, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm thinking that this bill affects only those whose offense happened before they were the age of 21.
Yeah, the juveniles. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And tell us what the situation is now in terms of people who committed crimes before the age of 21 and who've been sentenced to, obviously, life without parole. They get no parole. And this would, how many years would they need to be in prison before they would become eligible for parole?
Ooh, I think I've written in the I can't remember the years that I've written in there.
I have something on my notes, which I don't actually really understand. A mandatory minimum would become 1/3 for those with 30 years or less.
Yes, but that's a life sentence in Missouri. So in Missouri, we changed the statute a few years back because we didn't have a statute that allowed, we didn't have various statutes for juveniles. So we just had life without parole if they got life. So then we came back and we did we had a couple of representatives that wanted to do a hard 50.
And a
hard 50, meaning that it was 50 years flat. No probation, no chances of coming home, no anything. It was just a hard 50. That was the alternative that they was trying to present. So this creates another alternative for people that are locked up to actually be able to get released that hasn't been a problem in the correctional institutions. Because in the bill, it has several parameters that dictates the type of inmate the inmate has to be as far as not fighting, not getting written up, not going to the hole and things of that nature.
Well, how optimistic are you that this bill could pass?
The 85% bill every year receives a little bit of traction, a little bit of momentum. This year, Representative Galen Higdon had a committee hearing about 2 weeks ago. In the committee hearing in Judiciary, it was a decent committee hearing. It was a couple questions that was raised, and I believe that we're going to work to address that. So if we address those, I think we can get it out of the committee and onto the floor. I'm not really confident about anything passing this year, though, and that's not the people in the House's fault. It's the Senate has been in a stalemate pretty much all year, and they haven't been letting legislation out, which stalls everybody's.
And you mentioned in talking about this bill something about the 85%.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit more what that means?
Well, we're talking about the 85% minimums. So judges really don't have discretion when it comes to sentencing guidelines because the legislative body has chosen to write legislation in the favor of minimums as opposed to allowing judges to give time out on a time-by-time basis. We do have a few pieces of legislation that's moving through the process slowly that would actually address the mandatory minimums, but that's what the 85% is.
Do you think the climate around criminal justice reform has changed generally in this country, and has it changed in the Missouri House?
Yes and no. It's a slow wave of consciousness when it comes to being smart on crime, but when it comes to the political process and people that are in office, I believe that people in office are disconnected from the momentum that people outside of office has when it comes to criminal justice reform and understanding the need to address things like mandatory minimums or the need to address things like good time, which gives inmates incentive to actually not act up when they're locked up, or to address our drug laws and the ratification of some of our drug laws. So I think people that are in office are moving slow on it, but people outside of the political arena are more engaged in drastically changing our criminal justice structure.
How did you get so interested in criminal justice reform?
That's really, really, really simple. I grew up in the inner city, so growing up in the inner city, I seen law enforcement do a lot of things that I knew was against law enforcement procedures. So I studied criminal justice, I studied law, and in studying these, I understood that the political process is the only way that we can have long-term concrete change, and by being a so-called minority in America, I figured it was imperative that I got involved in the political process to control the rules of engagement and the rules of colonization that has been burdensome people that look like me and people that don't look like me that fall in the same economic stratosphere.
I know that a couple of years ago you sponsored a bill to do away with grand juries.
Yes.
Is that something that you still favor?
It actually is. I received a committee hearing on that bill. One of the most shocking things that came out of the committee hearing on that bill is the prosecutors didn't necessarily disagree with my interpretation of how grand juries are actually utilized. They didn't want to get rid of them, though. So when we talk about the grand jury process, we're talking about a non-court proceeding that most people believe is a court proceeding. So you have a judge in there, but the judge doesn't rule in there. He doesn't oversee. You have a defense attorney, but the defense attorney doesn't present anything. It's literally just a prosecutor's court. Anything the prosecutor wants to present in front of the grand jury, the prosecutor is allowed to present. And in the case in St. Louis, we've seen that Prosecutor Bob McCullough was willing to present information that he knew was not factually real, but he did it anyway. He also presented testimony of people that he knew was lying, and by his own admission, he knew they was lying. So again, it's a prosecutor's court, and it's something that we definitely need to address.
So do you plan to reintroduce that
bill?
Yes,
ma'am.
Last year, you introduced a bill that would track complaints about a police officer's behavior. And this system you devised would do so without violating discrimination rules that prevent police from discussing officers' performance.
Mm-hmm.
When I read about it, I thought it sounded like an awfully interesting idea. Could you talk to us a little bit about it and where that bill stands?
That bill is currently still in committee. We've had a committee hearing on it roughly about 3 weeks ago. So I've been working with the chair and a couple of members in the committee to modify the bill. So currently in the state of Missouri, we have POST, and POST is pretty much generates all police complaints. But in order to get these police complaints, you will have to subpoena it. Then the officer will actually have to sign off on it, et cetera. So I'm working with them to modify the bill to open up POST for police chiefs and captains to be able to review potential law enforcement officers that they're bringing in. So it's pretty much the same bill. I'm just modifying it to fit inside of the POST procedures that we currently have.
The POST procedure?
Yeah, and I can't remember the 100% acronym. It's something to do with police officers, but it's an internal police agency that gets all of their complaints. So basically, I'm just modifying my bill to open up POST now.
And from what I remember, it assigns
a tracking number.
Yeah. Talk to us about the tracking system, because that's interesting.
Now, see, this is the thing that makes the merger work even better. So what I was doing was creating a tracking number system on law enforcement officers. So say you got harassed by officer 12345. That 12345 will have a collection of complaints. The majority of police complaints that I've seen in the city of Kansas City, Missouri, come back non-founded because it is no hard evidence. So this would actually give hard evidence of red flags when you have an officer, like one of the officers that was in the projects in Kansas City, that had 65 complaints from 65 different people. Well, if you have an officer that's constantly getting pinged, then this officer probably is a problem. Now, POST already identifies that. The difference is POST will not make that information available to anybody because it's non-substantiated. So what I'm doing is merging my bill inside of the POST procedures that would mandate that POST opens up all the complaints to receiving agencies. If that makes sense.
I think it does. I didn't understand. You mentioned that there are discrimination rules that prevent the police from discussing specific officers' performances, as in the number of complaints they may have received about their behavior. Tell us, I'm not sure I understand why those rules exist. Why, if a police officer has received, 45 complaints about his interaction with the public, what's the thinking about having those discrimination rules?
Well,
why do they,
I'm just going to tell you what they said in committee, because I'm in the same accord with you that I don't believe that it should exist. So in committee, one of the concerns was that you will have people just writing complaints on officers to write complaints on officers. And my rebuttal was that's ridiculous because people don't do that currently. Right. So when it comes to law enforcement, investigating law enforcement and being a rule of thumb for law enforcement, there is no transparency in it, and it questions accountability. So by opening it up, I believe we will have a transparent and accountable process, but it is no real valid reason why you will hide anybody complaints, because we don't do that in any other industry. We don't hide doctors complaints. We don't hide complaints against lawyers. So why should we do it against law enforcement, which is charged with enforcing the law?
There are a couple of House bills that I see that I'd like it if you could talk to me a little bit about, because, further information. One is House Bill 351, which puts restrictions on detention and shackling of juveniles and shackling of pregnant women.
Yes.
Which sounds like an excellent idea. Then there is House Bill 407, which eases restrictions on housing of sex offenders in homeless shelters if shelters predate school or daycare centers. And it's that last part of what I'm reading that I didn't...
The sexual offenders part?
Yeah, that I didn't understand. The So if you would, talk about the HB 407.
First.
Yeah.
All right. When we talk about sexual offenders, and I have some legislation that's actually extremely tough on sexual offenders. When we talk about sexual offenders, they're all clouded up underneath that same cloud, and we don't segment them with the sexual crime that they may have committed. Example, somebody urinating in public can actually get indecent exposure and be on the sexual offenders list. Or somebody underneath the Romeo and Juliet law can actually be considered a sexual offender. So it has a caveats in there for the categories of the offender. But when we talk about sexual crimes and sexual offenders, I think we need to overtly change the way that we classify people. because when you first hear the word sexual offender, you're thinking of somebody that has done something hideous to a child. And this is the first thing, when I think of sexual offenders, that's the first thing I always think of, somebody that's molesting or raping children. I never think about the lower level offenses that people get written up for sexual predators, and they're on that list. So I think we need to broadly look at who we classify sexual offenders, and then we need to make sure that we're not penalizing people that haven't done things horrendous to individuals, such as urinating in public.
And so the stipulation about if shelters predate school or daycare center, that actually is sort of meaningless. It just means homeless. You can put sex offenders in shelters,
yes, ma'am,
for the homeless. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
And you mentioned the Romeo and Juliet law, and just that's kind of an intriguing little phrase. So tell me what that applies to.
That's pretty much dealing with teenagers. So if you have somebody that's 18 and 17 or 18 and 16, that would fall up underneath the Romeo and Juliet law, where you're not actually talking about somebody 50 years old talking to a 14-year-old kid. You're talking about somebody that's 1 year or 2 years within the age gap. And you will see some teenagers get locked up and get charged with sex offenders. We actually had a gentleman that came through the committee that was a sex offender. He was actually married to the woman that he caught the sexual offense charge from. And at the time, he was 18, and I believe she was 16. And the parents filed charges on him. He went to jail for like 10 or 12 years. Upon release, him and the young lady got married. They've been together. He's close to 40. I don't know his exact age. But they've been together upon release for about 12 or 14 years. And both of them testified how hard it is for them to get a job, how hard it is for them to fit into a community, because when people pull them up, it says a sex offender, but it doesn't say that he's married to the woman and that she was 16 and he was 18 at the time.
This is Margot Patterson, and if you're just tuning in, this is Jaws of Justice, and I'm here talking to Representative Brandon Ellington about prospects for criminal justice reform in the state of Missouri. Representative Ellington represents the 22nd District here in Independence in Kansas City. I noticed that not all of the bills seem to be going in the right direction. And there's one, House Bill 301, which takes away prisoners' right to request in-person parole hearings and would have hearings video conferenced. Yeah. Why this push to have video conferences? Is this regarded as an efficiency measure, or what is that about? And I'm referring to House Bill 301.
Yeah. About to be disrespectful. It's dumb legislation. So the ideology behind the representative that's pushing this is that it would save dollars. But when we talk about being able to physically interact with somebody that's up for probation, to be able to physically read physical movements, body movements, et cetera, I think that we need to keep the parole hearings in person. And it's also another underlying element to privatization in video conferencing or video parole hearings. So we have a wave that's been trying to privatize corrections, and we also have a wave that's been trying to privatize probation and parole services. It's actually a representative, almost as positive as the same one, but I don't want to say it without reading the bill number. It's another representative that has a bill currently that would privatize probation and parole services, which I believe would be extreme negative burden on our population. And I also believe it goes into corporations ruling penitentiaries, and we've seen some states start suing because they can't fill up their privatized prisons. And I fear that if we do stuff like this, we'll be in that same boat.
I've read, and this is, I think, was as of like 2 years ago, so it may no longer be true, that the Missouri imprisonment rate is 16% higher than the national average. Why is that, do you think?
Because penitentiaries is big money. So when we look at the state of Missouri, we'll see that 70-some-odd% of the inmates are so-called minorities, and 64 or 65% of the so-called 70% of the so-called minorities is locked up for nonviolent drug offenses. So when we look at the majority of the correctional facilities in the state of Missouri, the majority of the correctional facilities in rural areas. And I said all of that to go to something that a Republican told me a few years ago with a piece of legislation that I had. He was like, Ellington, I can't vote for this because I can't go back to my people and tell them I'm voting to take dollars away from our community. So when we look at the population density and allocation of funds, we'll see that rural areas like Boonville or some of the other areas that have our correctional facilities have a population increase of 10 to 20,000 residents because of inmates, which goes to federal allocation of funds and some of the other allocation of resources and state dollars. So we're talking about communities that benefit off of communities being locked up. And I think this is one of the reasons that we see a extreme push to lock people up at a long rate down here in Missouri. If you look at DOC's...
What does DOC stand for?
Department of Corrections.
Okay.
So if you went to doc.mo.gov, you'd be able to pull up corrections database. And when you look through corrections database, you'll see the so-called minorities are locked up for a longer offense for so-called drug abuses than anybody else when we talk about capital crimes like murder and rape and all this other stuff.
What are the chief barriers to criminal justice reform in the legislature?
Untangling economic benefits and merging in reality. So going back to the correctional facilities that's remain in the state, all of them are in rural areas, except for the level one correctional facility we have in Kansas City, which is KCRC, which is off of the West Bottoms. Besides that, all of your correctional facilities in rural areas. So you're talking about the allocation of funds, federal funds, state funds, et cetera, that's associated with incarceration or DLC. When we talk about overt criminal justice restructuring, now we're talking about untangling people's benefactor motivations. So most people that fight for criminal justice reforms does it out of personal knowledge or trying to fight for somebody that they know. Most people that fight against it fights against it because they have some type of benefit. Either they're a prosecutor, defense attorney, or something that benefits off the current condition that we have in the criminal justice arena. It's not that they don't understand that people that have opportunities to jobs will not come back to corrections. It's not that we don't understand that if we do certain mental evaluations and provide certain psychological and physiological rehabilitations that people won't be rehabilitated. It's not that we don't understand that if we provide educational alternatives in our correctional facilities, people won't learn, study, and rehabilitate themselves. We understand all of this. The problem is untangling economic benefits from reality.
That's interesting. So you almost have to come up or think of other ways that rural areas can
And I can give you an example. So I have a bill that will certify and bind inmates that are currently locked up in the state of Missouri. So the first time I had it in committee, one of the representatives stood up and he said that it sounds like I'm trying to turn corrections into community colleges. Mm-hmm. And he was extremely upset that I was willing to put all these benefits inside of correctional institutions when they should be there serving their time and learning the lesson. Well, the same representative the following year when I had it in committee, I learned a different way to articulate it because he was in the military. So I articulated from a military standpoint, and he stood up and he said, I understand. It's like me when I was in the Navy and I did all these jobs and I came back home in civilian life and I couldn't do none of them because I had no certification. Yes, it's the exact same element. So it takes understanding the communication that people interpret, not just words, but the language that people interpret and present it in a fashion in which they can internalize it, separate from just talking about the institution. So I think it takes a lot of conscious building and deconstructing of ideologies to actually get criminal justice reform overtly done.
Well, I imagine that this pattern that you're describing probably applies to other states,
yeah,
too. Are there any states doing things that you wish Missouri would consider doing?
Yes, but you actually got me on that question as far as being able to point to pinpointed examples. I do know it's programs as far as, so I don't be wrong on the states. But I do know it's programs that certain institutions have that I believe that if we did that here, it can greatly change corrections in the outcome of people being able to reassimilate. And I'll give you an example. In the state of Missouri, we have TVs. in the penitentiaries, right? So computer monitoring programs and all that, we can just as easily take these TVs that we have in there and we can do a two-way conference in which we hook them up with industries. That way people in there can become tradesmen. They can get trades while they're in there, which would guarantee that the recidivism rate would continue to stay low. Because in the state of Missouri, the recidivism rate jumps up drastically after the third year, which from an external standpoint, it would give somebody the understanding or observation that upon release, people are actually trying to do something positive or trying to reassimilate. And upon that third year, when they can't find a job, et cetera, they're more prone to commit a crime and get locked back up. So it's a lot of things that I believe we can do with corrections that we find in other institutions. I apologize that I can't point to the states, but that we find in other institutions that actually benefit both segments, the inmates and the citizens that the inmates are going to be re-engaging with upon release.
So the recidivism rate, that's interesting to me. I didn't know that recidivism rates went up after 3 years. Are there any other bills making their way through the Missouri State Legislature that you're following?
Yes, it is. It's a couple of them. I want to highlight a few of the other ones that I actually have moving and see if I can get community support on it. We was talking about sexual abuse. So I have House Bill 519. And basically what 519 does, it removes the statute of limitation for victims of sexual abuse and molestation, which pretty much makes the molestation of a child like murder, where the molester will always be on the hook for the molestation of that child. And again, that bill is moving through committee. The other bill we just actually talked about, which would have been the certification and bonding bill. And then I have I'm looking for the number. I don't see the number in front of me. I also have a bill, an innocent commission bill, that would seek to go through cases that have anomalies in them to see if we have people that should be exonerated and released from corrections. From the numbers that I've seen, when we have DNA, of a case that we didn't have DNA when we originally incarcerated the individual, I believe it's 8 out of 10 of those individuals are exonerated by DNA evidence. So what the innocent commission would actually do, it would be responsible for going through cases that have anomalies in them to figure out if this individual is somebody that should be locked up or if we locked up somebody that was actually innocent.
And when you say these are cases that have anomalies in them, what kind of anomalies are you talking about?
I can give you an example of an individual whose case I've actually read. And then it's also people in Kansas City that has read his case that has made public statements. So Ricky Kidd. Ricky Kidd is somebody that's locked up for life. He's locked up for murder. He has a lot of anomalies in his case, from witnesses recanting to one of the individuals that actually committed the murder saying that he wasn't with him, to some political influences involved in the case as far as who was prosecuting it, etc. He has a lot of anomalies. He has enough anomalies where anybody that's objective could look at his case and say either he's innocent or it needs to be reopened. And our former Mayor Pro Tem Alvin Brooks, about a year ago, was on TV, and he stated that he believed that Ricky Kidd was innocent after going through his case files and talking to people, et cetera.
What are some things citizens can do to support criminal justice reform?
Contact the Speaker of the House, and I don't have his information on me, but if you go to www.house.mo.gov, Todd Richardson is our speaker, and all his information will be up there. But it's actually contacting him and putting pressure on him to help move the legislation out of the House. And again, the Senate has been pretty much on standstill this year. So as far as getting big pieces of legislation out, I'm not really optimistic about stuff getting passed this year. And that's just because the Senate is pretty much blocking everything.
Well, maybe it'd be useful to know, what's the process a bill must go through?
Now, this is going to sound tricky, but every session it changes. So this year we have two committees. So you have the subcommittee, whichever committee you have it in. So like the bill I was talking about was in judiciary. And from judiciary, it goes to one or two rules committees. So after it goes to rules committees, then it's available to hit the floor. From the floor, you need 82 votes. And after it gets off of the floor, it's over to the Senate. Now, it's two players that's more important than anybody, and that would be the Speaker and the floor leader. If the Speaker chooses not to assign your bill, then your bill won't go to committee. If the floor leader chooses not to bring your bill up on the floor, your bill will never get floor time. But after it's out of the House, it's over to the Senate, and then the process starts all over again as far as the senators having to get it on the floor, argue it out, and get it voted on. In the Senate, I believe they only need 24 votes.
And how important is public pressure in getting a bill passed? Is it getting lots of citizens motivated to call their representatives, or is it changing the minds of individual legislators?
It's citizens. Now, it was citizens. The more citizens that get involved, the easier it is to pass legislation. So in the state of Missouri, we haven't done anything for Medicaid expansion, to give you a perfect example. The majority of the makeup at the House of Representatives is Republican. The people that's getting hurt the most by us not expanding Medicaid is Republicans, right? But the underlying ideology of their constituents is that this is Obamacare and we shouldn't pass it. The understanding from the representatives up there is that it's 300,000 people that we're denying health care. So the more people that get involved, the easier it is for us to pass legislation.
Well, Representative Ellington, thank you so much for being with us today. We're going to have to end it there.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Last week, the Rothko Chapel and St. Thomas University held a conference on undoing the legacy of mass incarceration.
My name is Allison Franklin. I'm with CEASE, which is a national anti-trafficking network, and then I'm also a board member on Texas Jail Project. Actually, I went to prison prior to being trafficked. I had an awful drug habit. I suffered from childhood sexual abuse. It launched me on a journey of self-destruction and spanned over 34 years. I got on drugs, and it was an easy way to manage my flashbacks and PTSD. And my addiction is really what put me in contact with violence, crime, gangs, prison, and then, of course, human trafficking.
Right, and you heard my comment in there that it is the heart of this aberration to our criminal justice system is the drug war.
Yeah, it actually fuels human trafficking as well, sex trafficking, absolutely.
Right, the same people are involved.
Oh, of course they are.
Yeah. Absolutely. What are you learning from this conference? What would you like to take from here?
That people care enough to, you know, create some type of reform. So I think that's a positive. Yeah. Polaris.com.
Sissy Farenthold.
Now, Sissy, we're here at St. Thomas, part of this examination of our criminal justice system. I think I know what brings you here, but are there any specifics that attracted you?
The whole subject, because it's been such an appalling failure, and it's created so many additional problems, right. That I just think it's imperative to move on it. And there's been more attention given to it, I'd say, in the last year.
Right.
So that's where we are now.
Yes.
But it speaks to every level of government. Yes. We have plenty to do on the state level and the local level, as well as the federal.
Now, I'm very proud thus far of our new district attorney, Kim Ogg. What's your thoughts in that regard?
Well, I think it's wonderful she's in office. And I'm very hopeful. I haven't followed it recently. I've been out of the state. But we'll work together there. Many, many people did. So we'll see.
Yes. Now, I hope you heard my thoughts in there. I didn't really have a question. I was just wanting to point out that it is the mechanism of drug war, which has definitely helped to escalate the draconian policies of our criminal justice system. Would you agree with that thought?
Yes, and it's gone to every level. I mean, it's affecting the whole new generation, even starting with children and what they're living through in these places. So it behooves us, all of us, to take give some attention and take some action.
Tune in for more from this conference on the next Cultural Baggage. DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.